This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Mike Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden announced Thursday civilian federal government employees must be vaccinated or submit to regular testing and wear masks. The strict guidelines are aimed at boosting sluggish vaccination rates among the 4 million Americans who draw federal paychecks and to set an example for private employers around the country. Biden's decision comes as the Delta variant of the virus that causes COVID-19 is rapidly spreading across the country. President said the same standards will apply to federal contractors. Biden also said he is asking the Department of Defense to explore how and when to add mandatory inoculations for the coronavirus to the list of vaccines required for service personnel. Biden added that the federal government will reimburse private employers who give paid time off to get vaccinated or take a family member to get shots. And he suggested more state and local governments offer $100 to those who get fully vaccinated. President also said his medical advisors say there is no need for a booster shot now if you are fully vaccinated. He said if the science tells us there's a need for a booster, that's something we'll do. Israel's prime minister announced on Thursday that his country will offer a coronavirus booster to people over 50, over 60, that is, who have been vaccinated. Thursday's announcement by Naftali Bennett makes Israel the first country to offer a third dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to its citizens on a wide scale. The decision comes at a time of rising infections and concerns that the vaccine's efficacy dwindles over time. For more news, join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. France's European Affairs Minister Thursday called Britain's decision to lift quarantine requirements for all fully vaccinated travelers around arriving from Europe, except France, discriminatory and incomprehensible, and said he hopes it is reviewed as soon as possible. The British government has said it's keeping quarantine rules for travelers from France because of the presence of the Beta variant, although the Beta variant reportedly accounted for fewer than 5% of the COVID-19 cases in France and mostly occurred in overseas territories from where relatively few people travel to Britain. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met his Vietnamese counterpart on Thursday to deepen cooperation and security and pandemic recovery after Washington pledged support for Southeast Asian nations embroiled in territorial rifts with China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. Austin's next stop are among China's fiercest opponents in the territorial disputes in the South China Sea, where Beijing has ignored neighbors' protests and has constructed several islands equipped with airstrips and military installations. In Hanoi, Austin and Vietnamese Defense Minister Phan Van John discussed cooperation in resolving the legacies of the war that ended in 1975, including the continuing searches for American MIAs, according to the Vietnamese Defense Ministry. Pedro Castillo took a symbolic oath Thursday as president of Peru, vowing to end corruption in the country. Castillo, a leftist political novice who has promised to be a champion for his country's poor, was officially sworn in Wednesday, less than 2 weeks after he was declared the winner of the June 6 runoff election. Castillo is Peru's first president of peasant origin. He succeeded Francisco Sagasti, whom Congress appointed in November to lead the South American nation after weeks of political turmoil. Castillo defeated his opponent, right-wing career politician Keiko Fujimori, by just 44,000 votes. And a defrocked former cardinal is the first in the United States to be criminally charged with sexual crime against a minor. Former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick has been charged with sexually assaulting a teenage boy in the 1970s, according to court documents obtained by the Boston Globe. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Friday, July 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. promises to deliver millions of COVID-19 vaccines to Africa.
The president has been very clear that we have to approach vaccine contributions around the world with the same urgency that we have here in the United States. And so we are working tirelessly to get out this first tranche of 25 million doses to Africa.
Zimbabwe nurses say a proposed Health Service Act amendment will infringe on their rights. A new poll says most Tunisians support the president's decision to suspend parliament. More Ethiopian refugees are streaming into Sudan. And an Equatorial Guinea civil society group is welcoming the guilty verdict of the country's vice president.
I have to say this is a very monumental victory for the people of Equatorial Guinea, who have grown accustomed to seeing the vice president flaunt his ill-gotten wealth on social media.
And Gambia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission is expected to deliver its final report today, Friday. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Aku Nankok, says ending the COVID-19 pandemic globally, particularly in Africa, is a top priority for the Biden-Harris administration.
The president has been very clear that we have to approach vaccine contributions around the world with the same urgency that we have here in the United States. And so we are working tirelessly to get out this first tranche of 25 million doses to Africa. We have already, in the past 2 weeks or so, donated the first 5 million doses into 16 African countries. Burkina Faso and Djibouti were among the first. But there's many more coming, and in fact, this weekend, we will be delivering the largest doses to any country, to South Africa at 5.6 million doses, and then to Nigeria at just over 4 million doses. And so this is just the beginning. These are the initial tranches. We remain the largest contributor to COVAX and are committed to getting vaccines out as quickly as possible, because we know that we cannot end this pandemic anywhere until we've ended it everywhere.
The World Health Organization says Africa needs about 200 million doses to vaccinate 10% of its population by September this year. Will the United States down the line be prepared and ready to give more?
So our vaccine contributions are, you know, they're multi-tiered and multi-layered, right? So this initial tranche of 25 million is the first step. But we are also doing other things, including supporting vaccine manufacturing on the continent. And so we have invested in vaccine manufacturing in South Africa and in Senegal to ensure that Africa can then produce its own vaccines moving forward. We are also providing economic assistance to countries that have been impacted by COVID-19, with over $541 million in assistance to respond to the economic after effects of the pandemic. And so this is just the beginning. This is an initial tranche of our assistance, and I'm sure that we will see more rolling out over the next couple of months.
Akuna Cook is the Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She spoke with Heidi Adams, host of VOA's Straight Talk Africa. The Executive Director of Equatorial Guinea Justice, a civil society group, has welcomed a French appeals court ruling that makes the country's vice president a convicted felon. Tutu Alakan says Western countries have an obligation to ensure that poor Equatorial Guineans benefit from the looted and seized wealth of the country's leaders. His remarks come after a French court upheld a guilty verdict against Teodoro Obiang-Nguema, Equatorial Guinea's vice president and the son of President Teodoro Obiang-Nguema Mbasogo, who was found guilty for financial malfeasance and fined $33 million. For the latest development, VOA's Peter Clotte reached Tutu Alakan, the executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice.
I have to say this is a very, very monumental victory for the people of Equatorial Guinea, who have grown accustomed to seeing the vice president flaunt his ill-gotten wealth on social media, while most people in Equatorial Guinea do not have access to medication for malaria, COVID, HIV, and other diseases. Of why most of our kids do not go to school because they're not teachers. I have to say, beyond that, globally, this is a huge fight too, you know, to see that the vice president of a country is held accountable, is by a Supreme Court determined to be a convicted felon. This is a huge victory for those of us fighting globally against corruption, against kleptocracy.
People are suggesting that the money will be paid back to the country, but how will it be used if it will be the same people controlling it? How does this work?
That is a very good question, and that is a work, that's something that we have already been engaging with the United States. As you might know, Peter, the Department of Justice in the U.S. confiscated about $30 million from the president and from the vice president of Equatorial Guinea. At that point, we presented them with several options, including scholarships to poor kids in Equatorial Guinea. They could go to other African universities, you know, in South Africa, in Kenya, in Ghana, all over Africa. They're great universities where monies could be sent directly to those universities and allow students to go over there, selected mostly by teachers. Equatorial Guinea has most of the best schools in Equatorial Guinea operate because missionaries are running those schools, you know, and those are not affected or impacted by the government's decisions. So there are ways in which you can do that. There are ways in which you can support local clinics. There are ways in which monies have been returned to other countries, Kazakhstan, for example, right, where you give a card to family members and they can use that card to extract money and pay for their kids to go to school.
But Tutu, some people are expressing concern that it appears that Equatorial Guinea and its vice president are being targeted by European countries or Western countries, and that was the reason behind the decision to close the embassy in London, because the British government slapped corruption charges against the vice president.
I think those of us that are Africans, we have to be shocked when a government is allowed, when a president is allowed to stay in power for 42 years. We have to be shocked when a president is allowed to put his son as the vice president, his other son as minister of mine, his daughter as minister of finance. We have to be shocked about those things. If what shocks us is that a country is able to hold these guys accountable, I think that makes us less African.
Tutu Alikand is the executive director of Equatorial Guinea Justice. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. The government of Zimbabwe has put forward amendments to the Health Service Act, which nurses say will infringe on the rights of workers to peacefully protest. Ade Gondo has details.
The planned amendments to the Health Services Act will require healthcare workers to give 2 days' notice in writing before starting any collective job action. In addition, all medical professionals will be required by law to provide care to patients in a medical emergency. Medical workers will no longer be allowed to go on strike for more than 3 days in a row under the proposed changes. Labor activists say the changes are an attempt to curtail the expression of their constitutional rights, especially the section that would impose jail sentences of up to 3 years for inciting or organizing an illegal job action. The government says the changes are intended to instill discipline in a sector that has been plagued by illegal job actions in the past. The proposed changes will designate healthcare workers as essential service providers as defined under the Labor Act. VOA spoke to Enoch Dongo of the Zimbabwe Nurses Association, ZINA, who says the bill is ill-timed and ill-advised at a time when worker morale is low.
It's not called for to come up with a bill that oppresses the workers without workers' contribution. And we don't expect a government at this point to waste time to put effort on issues that doesn't motivate its workers.
Dongo says already workers in the health services are reeling under a plethora of challenges led by inadequate pay and the lack of protective wear.
This bill will demoralize the spirit of all the health workers. And what will happen is the receiving end will be the end users, which are the ordinary Zimbabweans that relies on public hospitals, because these people are going to face a demoralized health workers. And we are appealing to the president to give orders to stop process of this bill until and when we overcome the COVID-19.
Longo argues the government must shift from the adversarial mindset, as the health workers' aim is nothing other than improving their welfare. Sociopolitical analyst Effie Ncube says the government is dealing with symptoms of a problem rather than the underlying causes.
So government needs only to attend to working conditions. There is no reason why government should go by way of a law to suppress constitutionally enshrined rights in order to prevent strikes. And the Constitution of Zimbabwe requires the government of Zimbabwe to operate in a democratic way.
Listen, labor activists say government consultation with stakeholders in the health sector would help plug the flow of medical professionals leaving the country for greener pastures. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 30th. In Tunisia, the latest polling shows President Kais Saied's decision to suspend parliament and fire the prime minister has majority support in the North African country. The study conducted by Emroy Consulting shows that over 70% of Tunisians support the president's decision. For the latest development, VOA's Peter Clotin reached Sherry Kadi, a political commentator based in the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
So let's start first of all with the director of the national television. Yesterday we had here in Tunisia an issue with the vice president of the Tunisian League for Human Rights and the vice president of the Journalists Union. They were not allowed to enter the building and to take part in a TV show. That was about the July 25th decisions and how we are going to move forward. So this has sparked a lot of indignation on social media. And the director of the national television said that it was orders or advices from the military to not allow anyone outside the whether the administration or the journalists that that are working in the television to enter the building. This sparked a lot of criticism, and the presidency, as well as the Ministry of Defense, they have denied such claims, and they said through their spokesperson that no, we didn't issue any order to the military to impeach anybody to access the building, and that we respect the freedom of speech and freedom of media, and there is no question of any kind of censorship.
With the political development so far, a lot of people are saying Tunisia is in a full-blown political crisis. Is that what you see on the ground?
On the ground, I mean, there is no kind of protest or demonstration. And of course, no clashes here between the two sides. The main issue is with the political elite or the political sphere. And what happened on July 25th was a normal consequence of a very deep crisis that has started months and months ago, with its peak being the COVID fourth wave. It is deadly for concerning the death rates due to COVID-19. We have overcrowded hospitals, deadly oxygen shortages, and unfortunately at the same time, the political elite, the parliament, and the prime minister, as let's say, resigning from taking their responsibilities to face the crisis. So this has really sparked a lot of indignation.
People have expressed concern that the president's decision to suspend parliament, to fire the prime minister, and to sack a large number of senior government officials is a power grab and a coup. How are people reacting to this?
Well, according to a very recent poll that was published yesterday, 87% of Tunisians agree with Kais Saied's decisions, and 76% they totally agree. It's even more than what than the score of second round of the presidential election. Let's remember that Kais Saied was elected with 72% of the voices. People really welcome it.
That was Sherif Kadi, a political commentator based in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Authorities in Sudan say at least 3,000 Ethiopian refugees fled into Sudan this week after the war in Ethiopia's Tigray region spread to the neighboring Amhara region. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities reported thousands of Ethiopian refugees crossing the border this week. In a phone interview with VOA, the head of Al-Gadarif Emergency Committee handling refugee camps, Al-Fatih Mugaddam, said the registered number of the new asylum seekers is 1,058. Mugaddam says the camps will struggle to absorb so many refugees, and he asked the Sudanese government and aid groups to quickly intervene. The majority of the new refugees fled from Ethiopia's Amharic region, bordering war-torn Tigray and the conflicted Al-Fashaga region between Sudan and Ethiopia. The war erupted in Ethiopia last November between the federal government in Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, after Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed accused Tigrayan troops of attacking federal military camps. The war in Ethiopia has caused a devastating humanitarian crisis, mostly in the Tigray region. Humanitarian aid agencies like the United Nations World Food Program, WFP, say more than 5 million people in the Tigray region are in urgent need of food aid. About 60,000 Ethiopians have fled to Sudan and are camping in the eastern cities bordering Ethiopia. Sudanese analysts like Ahmed Abdelghani warn the influx from the Amhara region might lead to tensions between Amharans and Tigrayans in the camps. Abdelghani says it's challenging because of the previous disputes between the two ethnic groups, with the Amharic group supporting the federal government of Ethiopia in its war against the Tigrayan people. He adds that receiving the new refugees in the same camps may cost Sudan a lot if the government didn't conduct security procedures to avoid any breakdown between the battling groups. The conflict in the Tigray region has worsened the already troubled relationship between Sudan and Ethiopia. The countries have engaged in a years-long dispute about Ethiopia's massive hydroelectric Gerd Dam, which Sudan and Egypt fear will cut off their access to adequate water from the Nile River. The Ethiopia government announced updated plans Tuesday for electricity generation from the dam after the second phase filling of the dam ended this month. Neba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission will deliver its final report today, Friday, to the government. 392 witnesses have testified before the commission since January 2019. This included former government officials and victims who tied former President Yahya Jammeh to the killing and torture of political opponents. Fatoumata Sandeng is spokesperson for the campaign to bring Yahya Jammeh and his accomplices to justice. She is also the daughter of Solo Sandeng, who was murdered in 2016 while in custody. She spoke to Ricky Stryak about the commission's expected findings and the next steps forward.
I would say personally, I feel like it's the first time in the Gambia, so we hope it's also the last time that it would happen. You know, to me, they have done well. They have tried to do a very good work. Well, into the fact that, like I already said, it's the first time they have tried to make sure that they reached out and they did everything necessary to complete their work and do it effectively, even though there are shortcomings and there are some things that some victims might not be happy with sometimes, but then one could understand those as they have been done with good intentions, but they have the purpose have been missed, and then one could understand that. But generally speaking, one could see that the TRC has done a good job by bringing victims and perpetrators speak up and reveal everything that has been happening in the country for 22 years under the Yameh dictatorship that is welcomed.
What do you want the next step to be after this final report is delivered as a spokesperson for the campaign to bring Yahya Jammeh and his accomplices to justice?
We expect that recommendations are sent to the government, which it is scheduled to be. If it is sent, we expect that the government take the recommendations of the TRRC very seriously and that it implements all the recommendations, especially the parts where recommendations would be done for people who bear the greatest responsibilities for crimes that were committed against Gambians and non-Gambians alike under the dictatorship to be brought to justice, to be held accountable, and to make sure that victims are also given reparations, which is not a kind of payment, but to compensate them, because you can't bring back a life. You can't undo the pains that one must have gone through, let's say torture or sexual abuse and all that.
Personally, as the daughter of opposition leader Solo Sandeng, your father was unfortunately murdered in custody in April 2016. What do you think from your own personal standpoint, not just as an activist, but as Solo Sandeng's daughter, how have you taken this into, you know, how has this affected you and your family?
Well, as you know, we were in Senegal, so we were in exile, and that was one, let's say, first thing after my father had been killed, the first effect that he had on my family. We had to leave the country and go to Senegal. We spent some time, some months, almost a year in Dakar. We came back. Basically, my father was the breadwinner of my family, so that would affect everything. We are a young family of 10. Generally, and also most significantly when it comes to justice, well, I testified at the TRC on behalf of my family, and we think that is a start, not only for our family, but also for the victims who came out, also for the perpetrators who came and talked about the things, the horrible things that they have done to Gambians, non-Gambians, like I said, alike. For us, it's not justice yet, but it is a way forward, and we hope that if the trend continues, that we see justice to be done.
That was Fatoumata Sandeng, a spokesperson for the campaign to bring Yahya Jammeh and his accomplices to justice. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Germany. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a wrap of day six activities at the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. South African swimming duo of Tajana Shoemaker and Kaylin Coberth both comfortably advanced to the women's 200 meters breaststroke final at the Tokyo Olympics after winning their respective semifinals on Thursday. Shoemaker, aged 24, and Coberth, aged 22, are training partners at Turks in Pretoria. Shoemaker, who won the silver medal in the 100 meters breaststroke, won the second semifinal in a time of 2 minutes 19.33 seconds. Earlier, compatriot Kaylin Coberth won the first semifinals in 2 minutes 22.08 seconds, out-torching American Lily King. In rugby, Kenya Lionesses went down fighting 12-35 to Russia in their second Pool C Rugby Sevens match at the Tokyo Olympic Stadium on Thursday. The Kenyan ladies had looked to be making a comeback after rallying from 14-0 down to trail 14-12 at halftime. However, the Russians put up an impressive display in the second half to secure their first win of the competition. They had narrowly lost 12-14 to Great Britain in their first match earlier, while Kenya lost 7-29 to New Zealand. Kenya will play Great Britain in their final match. The latter lost 21-26 to New Zealand in their final match. And the Athletics Federation of Nigeria on Thursday admitted lapses on its part over the disqualification of 10 athletes from Tokyo Olympics for not complying with out-of-competition drug testing requirements. The Athletics Integrity Unit had announced the disqualification of the Nigerian athletes. The AFN, which has been plagued by power tussle for several years, said they will take responsibility for the lapses that led to their disqualification. Day 7 of the Tokyo Olympics on Friday is the opening day of the athletics program. As you'll see, Ugandan talent Joshua Cheptegei, who last year broke the world records for 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters, go up against 20-year-old compatriot Joseph Kiplimo as they both attempt the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters double in Tokyo. In the women's 100 meters, the first round heats get underway with Ivorian Marie-Jose Tolu and Blessing Okabere of Nigeria, who are both expected to advance and later contend for medals. Part of Friday's opening athletics program will see reigning Olympic Games 5,000 meters silver medalist Helen Obiri lining up in heat 2 of a qualification round, with Ethiopian Godof Sege among the notable names competing alongside in the women's 5,000 meters. In basketball, the Nigerian women's basketball team, the Tigres, will be looking to continue the momentum they built up when they take on France in their second Group B encounter on Friday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.